Charging two students at Dartmouth University in connection with the death of a student over the summer who had a high blood alcohol content when he was found in a river after attending a party at a fraternity. This student says,
yeah, I was here this summer when that whole incident happened, and obviously it's very tragic, and I think the school is doing what they can to mitigate stuff like that in the future.
I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Harvey, I know you're the big FDR expert.
1934, he decided that the inequality and the wealth accumulated at the top was a threat not only to the American economy, but also to the American democratic spirit, American democratic life.
Sounds like history's repeating itself.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
Zomers, are you a Netflix and chill guy?
Do you know what Netflix and chill means?
I thought it just meant watch something on Netflix together.
You say that's what you're going to do, but you're really having them over there for sex.
This is why nobody wants to come to my place anymore. I say, hey, you want to come over and have Netflix and chill? People keep saying, well, no, I don't think so. I'll take it back. And I just thought they were being rude.
I do have Netflix, though.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trevi Olson, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project.
We as individuals need to be far better in terms of getting the tools we need to have the conversations. You're never going to shame someone out of their political beliefs.
Yes.
You're never going
yes.
to get yes. them with talking points.
You nailed it. And I think that's what some of our friends on the left don't get. And I think it's destructive and it's not beneficial.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Wisconsinites overwhelmingly voted yes on a record number of school funding measures, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum. That means people across the state are willing to increase their own taxes to fund their schools. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Voters favored a record number, 169 referendums, authorizing a record total of $4.4 billion in new funding for 145 districts. Denise Gomer Hutchison with the Wisconsin Public Education Network says districts are being forced to take their needs to the ballot box to fund gaps between prioritizing students and overdue bills.
The first responsibility of our public schools across the state is to educate children and to take care of the kids and the families that they serve every single day. So that means any available funds that public schools have, they put towards educating children. And so if that means a boiler has to be patched rather than replaced, that's what they're going to do.
Almost half of the state's 421 school districts passed a referendum in April or November. Hutchison blames the state for not adequately funding school priorities, from building maintenance to student mental health services. Regardless of whether taxpayers have children in public schools, she says the focus should be on providing every Wisconsin student with a quality education.
I want their experience in public schools to be as awesome as my 25 and 26-year-olds were.
The study found factors like inflation outpacing the state allocated per student revenue limits, the loss of pandemic aid, and staff competition in tight labor markets, all factors that contributed to the record number of referendums. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly cloudy, highs near 42. Cloudy tonight, we'll see a low around 31. Mostly cloudy, 46 for Sunday. Sunday night, clouds and 36. For Monday, a chance of rain with a high near 42. Tuesday, mostly sunny, a high of 33.
Right now, it's 37.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we will recap all the weekend's news, and we'll be joined by Dr. Kristen Lyerly in hour number two. We'll wrap it up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. This is News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly weekend venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm the host of Amicus, a law review. Delighted and honored that you have chosen to join me this weekend for this, our broadcast to and out throughout the state of Wisconsin in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We take our name, as always, our adopted commission to conduct a review, our analysis, some deliberations, some consideration of the recent news of our times from the word amicus, meaning friend, friend of the court, a person, an individual, an entity that somehow assists in understanding, in appreciation, assessment of some relevant issues that need resolution, disposition. And so consistent with the notion, the Latin word amicus, the legal word amicus, we'd like to think that we are your friend in providing you with some of those important insights that are relevant to your own assessment of your lives and your livelihood in the all-important areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Welcome to Amicus, a law review. With me in the broadcast station of Civic Media is my terrific, my fantastic producer, Jess. And indeed, she is animating not only the practical aspects of our production this weekend, but as you're going to hear, also has inspired at least one of our major segments in the second hour, having to do with the rule of law, some lessons from overseas. In that connection, let's talk first about the syllabus, the academic agenda before us in Amicus, a law review this weekend. We're going to begin, of course, with the significant breaking news that amends and adjusts in many ways the news we talked about last week, which was the initial decision by the president-elect to nominate Matt Gaetz as the attorney general, the chief federal law enforcement officer for the United States of America. That, of course, overtaken just this past week by the news that Matt Gaetz is no longer going to be that nominee, pulled himself out of consideration for all sorts of good reasons that we've talked about on this broadcast and others. And instead, within moments almost, the president-elect Donald Trump identified a new pick, a new selection, a new likely nominee for the chief federal law enforcement position in our nation. Her name is Pam Bondi. She's the former attorney general of the state of Florida. We're going to talk about Pam Bondi. We're going to give you some insight into who she is, where she comes from, what her experiences have been. It is important for all of us to appreciate this, again, because of the significance of what she is going to be supervising, a budget of nearly $38 billion, 40 different units. nearly 115,000 employees. We'll tell you more about Pam Bondi as we think about the encumbering of that all-important position at the top of the Department of Justice. That coming up first on our agenda here on Amicus. Then we're going to go to the other major rule of law story of just this past week, and that is the decision by Judge Juan Merchan not to proceed next week with the sentencing of Donald John Trump. Donald John Trump, as you know, convicted back in May of 34 counts of violations of New York law, felonies in the state of New York. This past Tuesday, we anticipated some major action by Judge Merchan in terms of his deciding on this all-important issue related to the applicability of that Supreme Court case, finding that presidents can commit crimes in office, the executive immunity decision. He was scheduled to announce his decision on that on Tuesday and then presumably continue with his oversight of the case by sentencing the president-elect the following Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, the 26th of November. Instead, major news of what did not happen, and that is not only did Judge Juan Merchan not issue that opinion, but he took off his calendar the sentencing scheduled for this coming week, the 26th. We'll also talk about what the district attorney, his name is Alvin Bragg, did in connection with that, his advocacy about what should happen next. And yes, you're going to hear again my own sense of outrage and of dismay and of great discouragement when it comes to the rule of law in this setting, that we're not completing that litigation, that prosecution, bringing it as it normally should be brought to a conclusion, at least in the trial court, with what? A sentencing. That's what we do in America after a defendant has been convicted of a crime. We sentence that defendant. We'll talk about what exactly it is that Juan Merchan did not do, what it is that's happening there in the Manhattan criminal court, and what we can expect, if anything, in the future from the disposition of that singular case that went to trial with respect to our president-elect, and what we can anticipate for the future of that case and the other three cases, which we have also talked about, that other state case in Georgia, the other two federal cases, one, of course, the election interference case in Washington, D.C., and then the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case that's pending in South Florida. The upshot of all of that, no spoiler alert here at all, simply an affirmation that all of those cases going to end not in clear dispositions, but whimpers. And we'll talk more about that. And then going into our second hour here on Amicus Law Review, lots of lessons from overseas. We, from time to time, go overseas to get some sense of rule of law, the administration of justice, and what does government do in foreign countries. This weekend, we're going to take a look at Brazil, some significant prosecution recommendations for the former president of the Brazilian nation. His name is Bolsonaro. As you well know, we've talked about him before. We're going to talk about also additional rule of law lessons and insights for America coming out of Hong Kong. Some major sentencings this past week, 45 people sentenced by the Beijing-led judiciary there, sending them to prison for anywhere between 4 and 10 years for pursuing the rule of law there, for exercising their right to vote, organizing a primary election. And we'll talk all about the lessons, the horrific lessons there, about what can and has happened in that autocratic state to undermine the basic trappings of what every person should be able to do, that is, have representation in their government after voting. Not in Hong Kong, shutting down this past week that major effort by many people there to ensure the continued independence, if that has been the case at all in recent years, at least the independence when it comes to choosing elected officials in the Hong Kong legislature, that brought to an end. And then, again, recommended many weeks ago by my wonderful producer, Jess, we're going to return to a story that we talked about at great length, and that is the devastating rape trial in France This is their version of the O.J. Simpson litigation. This case has been going on for 3 months. We're going to talk about some significant things that happened just this past week, including testimony from the family, the victim family, the family of the principal defendant who is charged with engaging in absolutely positively horrific behavior with respect to his wife, inviting others in to assault her sexually, the impact of that conduct now being played out in that French courtroom, understanding the significance of the victimization, and also pulling from that, as we've done before, some important lessons about what trials can and should do, not to completely erase the past. That can never happen. The imperfect results, of course, of a criminal trial, but the operation of justice, to bring to justice those people who would violate our basic norms, our basic standards of human behavior, and therefore compromise the safety and security of all of us. We're going to be talking again more about that French trial that continues to this day in that important nation. An ally of the United States of America also has something to teach us here in the United States about the meaning and the significance of trials and dispositions in a week when, in this major case coming out of Manhattan, we have seen none. All of that is coming up on Amicus, a law review. Thank you once again for joining me and Jess as we pursue all of these issues here on our weekend show. Let us begin then. Let us begin then with the major news about a person who is likely going to be our chief federal law enforcement officer. We know well now that in the wake, the good wake of Matt Gaetz's departure, a nomination that was probably doomed from the start, no credibility there. Stunning, if you will, that any president-elect would identify someone with no qualifications to do the job. And all of that, it's even charitable to call it baggage. But all of that information about his past behaviors, his violent criminal behaviors with respect to engagements, sexual engagements with minors, behavior that would otherwise have put him probably inside a federal courtroom, but for some compromises and some concerns about the prosecution that was abandoned by the Department of Justice many years ago. Nonetheless, that is his background. And as more and more information coming out about that became clear, even as the vice president and others attempting to continue to support that nomination, clear that it would fail, and it did. And Matt Gaetz withdrew his name from the president's set of nominees. And in almost instant follow-up, the president-elect identified Pam Bondi, B-O-N-D-I, Florida's former top prosecutor, as his next nominee, not yet nominated, but will be nominated to serve on his Department of Justice as the chief federal law enforcement officer. Let's talk about what we know about Pam Bondi. She is 59 years old, and she, again, is a longtime loyalist, undeniably, of President-elect Trump. She served on his legal team, not the head of the legal team, but the legal team nonetheless, in that first impeachment trial, and currently heads the legal team of something we've talked about here on this broadcast called the America First Policy Institute. You may recall our discussions of that in connection with the Heritage Foundation and all sorts of proposals for what a new Trump administration would show. We're going to talk more about Pam Bondi's contributions to that process, her history, and the other things we should know and the Senate Judiciary Committee should know as it takes up in the weeks ahead the nomination of Pam Bondi to be our Attorney General here on Amicus, a law review.
Listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
After raising the kids, having weddings, and getting them settled, my wife and I prepared to spend our very first Christmas alone. They were all at the in-laws this year, so we watched old videos of them growing up, went to bed early, and Christmas morning my wife said, let's never do that again.
We're on our own again this year, but we're actually looking forward to it because we rented a private vacation home in Alexandria, Minnesota. Lakes, shopping, restaurants, and new memories.
Explore your holiday getaway options at explorealex.com.
Earl Ingram.
Don from Milwaukee.
I enjoy your show right now at a time like this. You are great therapy for me. I don't know what I'd do without you guys.
We enjoy you as well. That's the importance of civic media and this platform. And Sandy and I take this seriously. We're going to continue to do whatever it is we can to make sure that people like you continue to get your voices heard.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
News from the center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host this hour and next hour as well, joined in the studios of Civic Media by my fantastic producer, Jess.
Hello.
And Jess, delighted to be with you this weekend. As always, it's been a little while. So pleased to discuss with you, both on the air and off, some of these major stories in the areas of rule of law, especially recently.
Yeah, it's been a busy few weeks here.
It has been. And I wonder, again, as I've often said to you, you and I are, I think, in many ways cut from the same cloth, although we are from different generations.
Yes.
Plainly, I am much older. I'm an old person. I'm wondering your particular perspective on frankly, any of this, but especially the issues related to the selection of an attorney general, the importance of that position for anyone, but especially someone in your professional category and your professional status here in 2024 and 2025.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we did get a new measurement of time attorney general nomination business. So that's interesting for those of you who may be wondering, if you ever need to refer to an 8-day period, you can just go ahead and call that a gates.
Right. Exactly. It's a new measurement. It's not metric system. It's a gates system, right?
Americans will use anything but the metric.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Good. And we will chat more with Jess throughout our broadcast this weekend. Again, delighted to be in partnership with her this weekend, as always, as we talk about the attorney general. This attorney general, presumably after nomination, will last more than 8 days, right, Jess? And will continue to serve in that capacity. So we should know something about her. We know, as I indicated before, that she was a part of Donald Trump's legal team during the first impeachment proceeding. Obviously, she and the other lawyers successful at that time, keeping him from a conviction in the United States Senate. You may recall that first impeachment based not upon the Russia matter, but based upon the outreach, the engagement by then President Trump with Volodymyr Zelensky and soliciting from him some assistance in investigating a family called the Bidens. And that resulted in that first impeachment set of charges. It goes to trial before the Senate. Pam Bondi was there in the floor of the Senate representing Donald Trump, which again brings her into partnership, if you will, with the others also nominated or to be nominated by this president to serve in other capacities. Other people have also had that attorney-client relationship with him. We've talked about that before and the concerns that that raises in connection with whether or not we can anticipate an arm's-length relationship between the White House and the Department of Justice when the relationship has been just that close.
Well, so my question here for you is there precedent for this of a president-elect choosing someone who has actually represented them and nominating them for this chief law enforcement position?
And the answer is in part that while I cannot speak to every single attorney general, there have been 86 of them during the course of our wonderful history. Certainly in recent times, there have been situations where our presidents have known
their attorneys general. But I am hard-pressed, Jess, during the period that I was with Department of Justice, to think about a situation where any of these attorneys general actually represented a president, certainly not in a criminal proceeding.
For
and that's
impeachment.
What we have.
I mean, this wasn't because of, you know, running a red light.
Exactly.
This was being impeached from the presidency of the United States.
No small thing. No small thing. And so, again, we have more unprecedented events going on here. Issues for the Senate Judiciary Committee planning to take up. In addition, right now, she is leading this group called the America First Policy Institute, which also has produced some documents that give a lot of animation to this incoming administration. Like the Heritage Foundation has published its own set of principles that they would like to see the new president embrace, including a lot of things related to the Department of Justice and government generally, including, as we have seen in the past, statements made by the president-elect, his interest in getting rid of the civil service and turning all of the employees, presumably all of them in the federal government, into at-will employees, subject to termination, firing, if in fact the president does, they do something the president does not especially care for. That is also a dramatic impact upon the entire federal workforce, but including the Department of Justice as well. In addition, Jess, to those things that we already talked about, it is important to note that Pam Bondi also oversaw the filing of many, if not all, of those lawsuits that followed the 2020 election. She was at the forefront of those lawsuits in those battleground states around the nation, advocating in those situations that, in fact, the 2020 election had been stolen. And she continues and has continued to articulate that view, even as she has been a surrogate and a mainstay personality in the recent campaign for this president. She has appeared for him in many venues around the country. And now going to be likely the nominee to serve in this top spot. She grew up in Tampa, Florida, the suburbs, young prosecutor with the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office, frequently appeared even way back then on local television before she ran for state attorney general as a Republican in 2010, served for a couple of years in that situation. And it is important to note that during the course of her time as the attorney general, she became the face just of a lot of issues that I suspect are near and dear to you, to me, to many of our listeners. And that is one of those. She became the face of the opposition to same-sex marriage in Florida.
Yes, she did.
She was defending a statewide ban that voters had passed in 2008. She said that she was obliged to do that because it was in the state constitution.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of being right or wrong.
Right. Exactly. The fundamental issue. And you've got an attorney general who should, in fact, just to your good point, should, in fact, be animated by those fundamental principles. Right. It was only after that mass shooting, which we all recall, that horrific mass shooting, the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016, that Pam Bondi adopted a somewhat more conciliatory tone toward the LGBTQIA community. And nonetheless,
this is not a warm and friendly relationship. This is still very much at arm's length.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, probably in many ways because of the locality of it, you have this absolutely horrific event visited upon all Americans, including the LGBTQIA community there in Orlando. An attorney general should be sympathetic to any horrific thing like this, but she certainly had previously articulated a view that same-sex marriage should not happen in Florida. She focused, to her credit, on combating drug abuse, child trafficking. She also, however, was a part of the partisan legal fight against, that's right, the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. We're going to talk more about Pam Bondi as Amicus Law Review continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Stay with Jess and me for all of that and much more.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Major storms on both coasts have knocked out power to over 200,000 customers and could complicate pre-Thanksgiving travel. Another complicating travel factor, the threat of a strike from service workers at Charlotte Douglas International Airport. That airport alone expects over 1 million travelers before Thanksgiving. Dorothy Griffin is one of the workers who sanitizes planes and provides wheelchair escorts.
We're not treated fairly. We're not paid fairly. We're not respected in our jobs. What we do, and we just want higher, you know, more wages and a little respect.
They have not said when they could strike. President-elect Trump met Friday with NATO's Secretary General in Florida. It's their first meeting since Trump's election as tensions mount over Russia's war with Ukraine. President-elect announcing a slew of cabinet choices Friday, including Scott Bessent, a billionaire hedge fund executive, the choice for Treasury Secretary. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks outpace Indiana. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks jumped out to an early lead at five-serve form and went on to beat the Pacers 129-117. Another triple-double from Giannis with 10 rebounds, 11 assists, 37 points. The Bucks are now 7-9. Tonight, they host the Charlotte Hornets. Men's college basketball, Wisconsin with an 86-70 victory over Central Florida at the Greenbrier tip-off tournament being held this weekend in Orlando. The Badgers remain undefeated at 6-0, and they're going to face Pittsburgh tomorrow at 4:30 to wrap up their trip. The Boys High School State Football Tournament ended last night with Green Bay's Bayport High taking the Division I state title with a 25-18 win over Muskego. NFL Packers and 49ers tomorrow. San Francisco without their starting quarterback, Brock Purdy. Brandon Allen at quarterback, but they still have a lot of experience on offense.
You know, they got a veteran group and a lot of guys that's, you know, top players in this league. It's going to be a big game, you know, we get to see you on Sunday.
That's the Packers' Kenny Clark. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly cloudy, highs near 42. Cloudy tonight, we'll see a low around 31. Mostly cloudy, 46 for Sunday. Sunday night, clouds and 36. For Monday, a chance of rain with a high near 42. Tuesday, mostly sunny, a high of 33.
Right now, it's 37.
It's the sound of a soda, considered one of the coolest things made in Wisconsin. Jolly Good has been around since the 1960s. Cryer Foods makes it in Random Lake, which is in Sheboygan County. But Cryer started as a canning company in 1913. What was being canned there? Sauerkraut? Peas? Beets? The answer coming up.
At Jolly Good, we believe in quality.
Soda turned into an important revenue stream when production at the canning company slowed in the colder months. So what was being canned there? Sauerkraut, peas, beets? All three, plus juice, soups, and more. By the 1960s, Cryer quit canning and went all in on Jolly Good soda.
For flavor and value, Jolly Good's got it.
The latest resurgence of Jolly Good makes it a slice of Wisconsin for yesterday and today. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Alba Show.
Zomers, are you a Netflix and chill guy?
Do you know what Netflix and chill means?
I thought it just meant watch something on Netflix together.
You say that's what you're going to do, but you're really having them over there for sex.
This is why nobody wants to come to my place anymore. I say, hey, you want to come over and have Netflix and chill? People keep saying, well, no, I don't think so. I'll take it back. And I just thought they were being rude.
I do have Netflix, though.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt Nair on air.
And we are here with Matt Randolph, Mr. Global. Donald Trump now will be coming in for a second term. There has been talk of removing sanctions from Russia. What would that mean, Matt, for the oil and gas industry?
So it depends on what Russia does, but we've seen nothing to suggest that they want to have anything to do with lowering oil prices.
And so the prices are essentially going to stay the same?
In all likelihood, yes.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody, join us on Monday. We'll take a look back at what made news over the weekend and get you ready for Thanksgiving week. Tourist travel tips. Join us then.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, joined in the station by my outstanding producer, Jess. Delighted to have her be a part of our conversation this weekend about all of these important rule of law issues, including a review, an initial review, an assessment of the likely incoming Attorney General of the United States of America, her name, Pam Bondi, talking about some of the positions that she has taken in the past. They are relevant to understand who she is and what she may do in connection with her new duties coming up in Washington, D.C., in addition to identifying some very legitimate legal fights in terms of promoting the safety and security of people in Florida, focusing again upon drug abuse and child trafficking, those kinds of things. Significant that she also led one of the major fights, continued to lead fights against Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. She also opposed during her tenure the legalization of medical marijuana, opposed that as well. Other things during the course of her tenure are significant. And one of those goes directly, from my perspective, to questions that once again should be asked of her when she is appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, determining whether or not she should be confirmed by the United States Senate. Now, Jess, you may recall well, I know you do because I know you're the student of the news, that there was a time in America when our present and our future president, our president-elect, Donald Trump, had in place something called Trump University.
Yes, I know where this one's going. I did some research on Pam Bondi today.
And right. And so, you know, that I'm guessing, Jess, that you are not a graduate of Trump University.
I hold a degree from the highly accredited University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Outstanding. Of course, a hugely important and underscore legitimate and wonderfully academic institution right here in Wisconsin. Trump University, unfortunately, does not have the credentials of a University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we knew that probably from the start, focusing ultimately upon real estate and property issues.
Uh-huh.
An awful lot of people early on saying, gee, I'm attending this university. I'm paying tuition, lots of money.
Hefty tuition,
right? And ultimately saying, I'm not certain I'm getting the education that I would get at a University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee institution. And reporting, among other things, one of them, for example, began to complain about this, said, gee, I don't know that advice from my professor that one of the ways that I should become a real estate agent, a good real estate agent, is simply to increase the credit line on my credit card. That was the kind of instruction being given. And so ultimately, this, of course, attracts the attention of an awful lot of people. Appropriately, students reach out to their attorneys general in states around the country because they've enrolled in the Trump University. And those students are around the country. Many, many attorneys general take notice of the fact that there is a trend here that people are having problems not just graduating from Trump University, but even getting a basic education there. And ultimately, they investigate. And to cut somewhat to the investigative and civil prosecutorial chase on all of this, they ultimately determine that Trump University really is a product of fraud.
It is a scam.
It is a scam. And that, regrettably, they're victims of that scam, as you have appropriately identified, Jess. And those victims are the students. And it is the responsibility, of course, of attorneys general throughout the United States of America, including right here in Wisconsin, in Florida, which gets us closer to Pam Bondi, all of them, on behalf of the victims, the constituents in their states, to try to address the kinds of fraud, the scam events that were going on inside of Trump University. So the attorneys general, not all of them, but many of them across the country, get together and file independent lawsuits, collaborative lawsuits. Ultimately, Donald Trump and Trump University required to pay as damages $25 million with an M dollars to try to compensate to some, not all perhaps, and imperfectly compensating the students of this fraudulent university. Along the way, initially, Pam Bondi's attorney general office is a part of that investigation. And what happens is, as the decisions are being made to sign off on the complaints and get those pieces of litigation underway, Pam Bondi decides not to go ahead with her involvement on behalf of the victims, the student victims in Florida. And Jess, I'm guessing you know the reason why that might have been.
Well, yeah, it wasn't because she decided to investigate and didn't believe that there were legitimate claims here.
Instead, there's an awful lot to suggest because of the timing that in 2013, she got a donation from whom?
From Donald Trump and a significant contribution of $25,000, if I'm not mistaken.
That's exactly right. You're not mistaken, Jess. And that is a significant political donation to keep her in office. And of course, Pam Bondi at the time, when confronted with this, we didn't find out about it right away, but confronted with it, she said, you know, we made an independent decision to not to pursue this. Nothing to see here. The donation had nothing to do with the legitimate decision that she made. And in fairness, Jess, you and I both know, we've talked about this a lot on this broadcast, others. All the time, prosecutors have to make tough calls, both in the criminal area, the civil area.
As they should.
They should, right? That's the reason why we commission them to do this work. They make decisions based upon the law and the facts, whether the law will support it, the facts support it. And that's the point that you just made, Jess. The question is, and the question that needs to be asked about this matter, because it is relevant, it's highly relevant to the future encumbering of the attorney general's position by Pam Bondi. What happened here? What about this particular circumstance? She plainly, I assume, would tell the members of the Senate committee that the one had nothing to do with the other. But the other part of this is the Senate Judiciary Committee should also look beyond just her testimony. The question is, and appropriate for the Senate Judiciary Committee to ask for documents, memorandums, subpoena those things if necessary. Find out, were there memorandums? What were the contemporaneous writings about this that may or may not have memorialized the exact reasons why she, as opposed to many of the other attorneys general, did not join this lawsuit. And here's the reason why all this is so important. All the other things are reasons for exploration or positions on past issues. And reasonable people can argue with her and others about some of that. This is a situation where the question is, are you motivated by politics?
Yes.
To make those important decisions, as in this case, the chief state law enforcement officer there in Florida. And if you've done that in the past, will you do that when you become the federal chief law enforcement officer? That's the question.
I think you can almost reword that and say, is there any reason to expect that you won't?
Your history has suggested that you're inclined to do this. And members of the Judiciary Committee on all sides of the political aisle deserve some answers from her. Not only, presumably, once again, she would commit to not doing it in the future, but it is a source of great, great concern. Again, not that the other matters are secondary. All of those things should be looked at. This one goes specifically to the judgment, the discretion, the integrity of the nominee.
Absolutely. Will she do the job of chief law enforcement officer in this country to advocate for the people who need justice?
That's exactly right. In so many ways, as we've talked last week, there are so many areas of the work of the Department of Justice that are critically important, not only to victims of crime, but victims of civil fraud, all sorts of other things that support and keep us safe and secure. Their operational units, the cops office, the community relations service we talked about, all sorts of investigative agencies, the DEA, the ATF, the FBI, litigation divisions, antitrust, tax, environment, all kinds of things that are critically important, civil rights to the future of America. We need desperately to have an attorney general in place who will understand not only the work that needs to be done in those areas, but will take an approach to it that has a complete sense of integrity, that if indeed the president at any time should pick up the phone and call her, as he did during the course of her continued relationship with him in all of these other areas, call her Pam and ask her to do something on his behalf. Will her allegiance be to the Department of Justice, more importantly, to us as United States citizens, or will it be to the President of the United States of America? That's the focus. That's got to be the focus of this nominee.
Absolutely.
And that's the reason why this particular matter, with respect to Trump University, many years ago, nonetheless remains relevant today and should be among the list of things that the president should be focused on as she makes that nomination. And also, most importantly, the people of the United States of America should be focused on as this nomination goes ahead. All of that coming up, obviously, in the future of our nation. We know that those nominees are going to be forwarded again, in this case, to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, many other committees of the United States Senate taking up other areas. Yes, in the areas of education and national security and defense, all those kinds of things where we have other nominees who also deserve a great deal of scrutiny when it comes to determining in their advise and consent role, what should the Senate do? And there have been, plainly, as we know, situations where the Senate has said, Mr. President, we do not agree. And nominees have to be rejected by the Senate. Again, a majority vote is all that it takes in the Senate to confirm or to reject, to send a nomination back to the White House with a request for a new nominee.
And that's a simple majority, just 51, right?
That is a simple majority. This is not a situation where you've got legislation that requires that infamous thing that you and I have talked about, Jess, which is the filibuster. That's the 60. That's mm-hmm. the supermajority for nominees, including these nominees, of course, for the federal bench, including the United States Supreme Court. You need 51. In fairness to this nomination, here is what the president-elect said about it. He said, Pam will refocus the DOJ to its intended purpose of fighting crime with a capital C and making America safe again with a capital M, a capital A, a capital S, a capital A. Mm-hmm. He said that in a social media post announcing the selection, he said, I have known Pam for many years. And yes, indeed,
yes,
he
we
has.
Know.
That is one of the concerns about the nature of that relationship. How close is it? And can the president once again pick up the phone and call her to rely mm-hmm. upon that relationship, an attorney-client relationship about which we should never and will never know anything? We shouldn't. That's the way the attorney-client relationship works. He said she is smart, she is tough, and she is an America First fighter. That's plainly a reference to her present role in the legal arm of the America First Policy Institute, who will do a terrific job as Attorney General! And again, in all of these situations, if indeed she is confirmed, it is a good thing, and we should anticipate that all of our nominees, including the Attorney General of the United States of America, we hope that they are successful, and successful by that we mean with a small s, in promoting the interests of justice, of rule of law, mm-hmm. of the good things that America should be all about. That's a successful Attorney General, and
yes.
again, not someone who has a close relationship with the White House in such a way that takes instruction from the White House about the ways in which those prosecutions, civil, criminal, about how investigations should go, about how monies, the literally billions of dollars now within the control of the Attorney General should be allocated and used well, thoughtfully, productively inside the U.S. Department of Justice. All of that coming up as we continue to think about nominations here in the United States of America in the incoming administration in just about 60 days or so. The other major news story, of course, comes out of New York City, not Washington, D.C., New York City. And that's the decisions coming out of the Trump trial there. Decisions by the presiding judge and by the district attorney. As Amicus Law Review continues, we're going to talk about that other major rule of law story. And again, underscoring my great disappointment with what just happened there. We'll explain exactly what that was as Amicus, a law review, continues. continues.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
My son loves to fly kites, but my active psoriatic arthritis can sometimes hold me back. Now with Skyrizi to treat my skin and joints, I'm ready to go. Skyrizi, risankizumab riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults, helps with less joint pain, stiffness, swelling, and fatigue. For those who also have plaque psoriasis, 90% clearer skin is possible with just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
With Skyrizi, there's nothing like clearer skin and better movement, and that means everything. Ask your doctor about Skyrizi today and visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Jim Santel. I am your host here on Amicus LawReview in the remaining moments of our first hour of our weekend broadcast, continuing into a second hour. And in connection with the continuing focus that we always have on the rule of law on this broadcast, let me resurrect an issue, a thought, a perspective that I first articulated in our broadcast last weekend, citing from a small but important writing of Professor Timothy Snyder from Yale University. He wrote a book called On Tyranny a number of years ago, long before Donald Trump was in our political national attention. He said 20 lessons from the 20th century about the circumstances, the things that all of us should do if we are concerned about the future of government. And just the number one principle, it is literally number one of the 20, is this. And it is relevant to our next news story here on Amicus. Timothy Snyder says this. He says, do not obey in advance. Do not obey in advance. And here's his commentary, much more extensive in the pages right after this. But this is his summary of that fundamental principle. He writes this. He says, most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. In times like these, again, he was not referencing the times that we are speaking about right now, but it's certainly relevant to all periods of time. In times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want and then offer themselves without being asked. A citizen who adapts to this in this way is teaching power what it can do. Compelling words about not obeying in advance, not anticipating what a next government will do, and conforming your conduct presently to what may happen in the future, effectively conforming your conduct to abandon your fundamental principles about the rule of law, about due process, about even something as simple as basic criminal procedure. And that leads me, in the words of Timothy Snyder, with his commission about not obeying advance, to get into our next story about what happened just this past week, Tuesday, in Manhattan. Jess, you know well, because we've talked about this as well, anticipating are being together for this broadcast this weekend, that I fully anticipated that in this broadcast we would be doing a dramatic reading of Judge Juan Merchan's order. And that order, Jess, as you know, was going to be this. He was going to describe the ways in which, presumably, that Supreme Court opinion issued on July 1, I have railed against it for many months and weeks now, that Supreme Court opinion finding that indeed there is a a principle inside our Constitution that says that a president can commit crimes with impunity. The question, the homework given from the Supreme Court then to other judges in all these cases is figure this out. What does this mean with respect to all the other cases? And indeed, in the wake of that decision, July 1, of course, as we know, that landed likewise in the courtroom of Judge Juan Merchan. Now, Juan Merchan had weeks, actually months earlier, presided over that trial, the singular trial that proceeded against Donald Trump among all these four. In the wake of that, lots of very colorful testimony that we talked about and reviewed, America riveted to that in many ways that we haven't been riveted to a trial in a long period of time. In the wake of that, a jury duly constituted returned a verdict unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump had engaged in, yes, that's right, 34 counts of violations of state law, false statements, false representations, fraud, in terms of putting together documents to do what? To cover up the fact that he and Michael Cohen, co-conspirators, other people involved directly and indirectly, to cover up the fact that he had an affair long ago, and that if that affair was disclosed during the course of the 2016 campaign, that would plainly have an impact. That was the reason why that case, although it was sometimes referred to as the documents case, for sort of dry case, actually wasn't. It was actually an election interference case going way back to 2016. And so the assignment coming out of July 1 was, what do you do with that in the wake of the conviction in a case that is against a defendant who is not, at the time, the president of the United States of America? Juan Merchan initially, as we know, has scheduled the sentencing, which is what we do in America once there is a conviction, has scheduled the sentencing for Donald Trump on July 11th. That, just as you know, is a week before the Republican National Committee met here in Milwaukee, right here. That's a
goodness. Was that months ago? Was that days ago? Was it years ago?
A long time ago, July 11th. And of course, what happens then is Judge Merchan says, OK, we'll take more time to figure out whether or not this homework assignment given to all of us by the Supreme Court to determine whether or not there's something about this state trial involving non-official acts of a person who wasn't even a president at the time, does that apply? And so presumably an awful lot of people would say, no, there's no applicability to that. But Juan Merchan said, okay, I'll solicit from all of you some views about all of that. And in the meantime, what I'll do is I'll suspend the sentencing. I'll take that from July 11th. I'll put that instead into September. And he did that and said, I'm going to announce my decision, not only about the immunity decision, the immunity ruling, but also I'm going to reschedule the sentencing for mid-September. We'll do all of those things sort of in series, but close in September. And again, solicited views and perspectives from all the attorneys, counsel for the defendant, Donald Trump, for the prosecution. His name is Alvin Bragg. He's the DA there in Manhattan. And in September, again, Juan Merchan said, you know what? We're too close to the election. In the midst of this unique period in American history, I don't want to influence the election. I don't want to be viewed as being partisan in some way. And so I'm going to postpone this yet again. Mm-hmm. And he postponed the election and his decision, his predicate decision on this issue related to immunities. He postponed that until, let's all look at our calendars, November 19th. Yes, oh, that's right. It was just last past week, Tuesday, and said as well that I'm going to postpone the sentencing until November 26th, which would be this coming Tuesday. And that is the reason why just you and I and others here at Civic Media and around the country woke up on Tuesday morning and thought we were going to hear from Judge Juan Merchan, his announcement of this decision, and presumably telling us all that there's no applicability to this of the Supreme Court case to his trial. He did not do that. And as the silence grew during the course of the morning hours in Manhattan, what happened was nothing. And when we come back here on Amicus Alarm, we'll tell you exactly what did and did not happen and the reasons why that result on Tuesday speak volumes about the rule of law in America and speak a lot to the criminal justice system with respect to one person in America who does have priorities and privileges that none of the rest of us has. All that coming up on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is News from the Center, WRCE. Dom Salvia.
Next time, former Wisconsin gubernatorial candidate Tim Michaels turns down a Trump cabinet position. Is he lazy or just against divesting? Also, MTG claims subpoena power. Who's she coming after? Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Dom Salvia Show.
State Senator-elect Jody Habish-Sinikin. What's the best way, do you think, it is to approach a difference in not just opinion, but in what we perceive as facts with those that may not be aware or don't agree with it?
First, having a conversation. Try to get an understanding of what is really bothering them and try to offer solutions at the state level or at the local level where there can be progress.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.